Well, hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and all that kind of stuff. We're back again. It's Thursday, and Thursday is, well, it's that day, it's that time of the week, isn't it? It's the 21st of March, the first day of spring, so we'd better sort of spring forward with everything. Welcome to the show. This week's show is going to be like deja vu all over again because we have a returning guest who's returning immediately. How about that? I know some of you are probably thinking, oh, Paul's getting lazy, right? Having the same guest on 2 weeks in a row. Too right. And I've got the sniffles this week, which should make it more fun, and I'm armed with a bit of chop juice to keep me going through the show. But we'll just let everybody else do all the talking, including you, dear listeners, if you like. So you're listening to Paul English Live. We're here every Thursday at 8 p.m. in the UK, usually 3 p.m. in the US, but we've still got the clock madness going on, so it's just gone 4 p.m. US Eastern. So, hi everybody, welcome back to the show. It is, as I said, Thursday, the 21st of March, 2024, the first day of spring, and I went for a little spring walk here today, although yesterday was more spring-like for us down here on the jolly old beautiful south coast of England. It's not always jolly and it's not always beautiful, but it's still pretty old. Wonderful sea fret today. That's always quite interesting. I had to pop up to the post office to drop off huge packages to be sent to very interesting people all over the world, and a sea fret moved in. It went Dickensian for about an hour. So this was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and the fog fell in, thick as a soup. Wonderful stuff, really. Nice smell of salt on the air. So instantaneous atmosphere. I hope you've all had a pretty good week. I've had a not bad week. My son decided to give me a head cold, which was really rather kind of him. But he's made up for it about 10 minutes ago by offering me some tissues for the show so that I can blow my nose. Although I've got to use the, I think there's an anti-nose blowing sound button. It's called the mute button, which I'll try to make use of as we go through the show. As I mentioned there at the intro, we've got a radically different, by the way, we've got a radically different picture for this week's show. It's exactly the same as last week's, but the cog for the show is a different colour. Hey, don't say that we don't take artistic licence here. My guest is a returning guest, as you well know, and he is Thomas Anderson, the author, and we're going to be talking about time. To start off with, I think, if we've got enough time. But Thomas, are you with us here today at the start of the show? Oh, hang on just a minute. You are, but I should probably unmute you here at my end so I can hear what you say. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm sitting here listening for already 15 minutes, listening to you talking about this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. No, it's good. Let me just bring your volume up a little bit. There we go. I think that's fine. Yeah, no. Well, there's crazy stuff to talk about, really. It's England. There's usually crazy stuff and have to sort of zone in on things. And yeah, I had to go to the post office today. I know you didn't think we'd be talking about the post office right at the beginning, but here we are talking about it. And, you know, I don't know how often you mail things out, but I used to do it loads. And then I realized as I was bumbling around trying to find, you know, sellotape and things like this, that I don't do it at all. And it took me about an hour and a half to get this package together, which I had to send off to one of the packages I had to send off was to the Customs and Excise here in the UK, who've overcharged me on a package, which I got quite cross about. So I had to send this big, elaborate letter back with lots of evidence of my goodness and all this kind of stuff. So it's all a bit of a palaver, but that's what my day's been about. Of course, as I just mentioned then, you were here with us last week, but minus the first 3,600 seconds, which was very interesting. And I said, you know, we did have a little bit of a joke at your expense because of that. But here you are, bang on time. We ended up talking about time, or you did at the end of last week's show. And I think that's really the main reason why we've kind of got you in. Not that I want to spend the whole of the time talking about time, but we were talking about the second, the actual length of it. And so this is the second time that we're going to talk about the second. Isn't it? I think. Possibly.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. And we have a few tunes lined up. That long one you sent in, by the way, is possibly too long, really. I mean, it's just 6 hours. It's a bit, no, it's 8 minutes, isn't it? 8 minutes or so. But if we can squeeze it in, we can. And there was one of the songs that you sent from last week. We never got time to play, actually. So we've got that one still waiting in abeyance, as they say. And a quick shout out to Paul for producing these as usual at the 432 hertz naughty frequency, which is what we do. And I will send you copies, Thomas, after the show as well. But it's good to have you back. It's amazing to have you on time.
And just right on the second, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I know, it was just we were stunned. We thought, what, Teutonic efficiency? It's all gone out the window last week. And no, here you are. It's fantastic. So have you had? What's your week been like? Have you had enough time this week to have a good week? How's it been?
Well, I was driven by the normal day-to-day routine and some small problems popping up here and there, but all solved, all okay. And the weather wasn't too good. There was some rare sunshine only here, and we had some rain, lots of rain, definitely.
Oh, good.
Yeah, too much.
Too much rain. Yeah, we don't even bother with it over here. It just rains every other day, really, most of your life if you live here. It just rains it, basically. But, yeah, no, that's good. So, last week, when we were winding down towards the end, we got round to talking about the second, didn't we? And I think we might as well get this bit dealt with. Because you were making some wild and ridiculous claim that it's not the same length as it used to be. And it might be worth just recapping right at the beginning here, just about, you know, where you were ending up last week, about this situation with calendars, with months, with moons, as they are. That's really where the word comes from, isn't it? Yeah. We should have 13 moons of the year. The fact that we used to have 360 days in our year, as in the same number of degrees in a circle, which is very interesting and quirky, because, yeah. I mean, 360 is an amazing number for all sorts of reasons, because it's divisible by so many numbers. I mean, it's a phenomenal number, is 360. You can divide it by, well, a lot. I won't go through the whole list, but there's an awful lot of numbers that divide into 360. And yet something hit here a long time ago, banged us on a big longer orbit or something. Look at me. I'm garbling it so you can step in and correct me. Okay, you can say, no, Paul, it's not like that at all.
Okay.
And then we're out to 365 days plus an extra quarter of a day, apparently, which results in the leap year, which we had just a couple of weeks ago on February the 29th. So that's my recap of it in my garbled English-type way. What's yours? What's
okay,
yours?
Now, I will try to present the professional way. So now on our planet, we have the most, in most countries, we have the Gregorian calendar. There we count 365.2425 days. Before the Gregorian calendar, we had the Julian calendar. The Julian calendar started with Julius Caesar in 46 before Christ and ran until 1583, when I remember it right, where we then switched to the Gregorian calendar. The Julian calendar didn't have 365.2425 days, but 365.25 days. A very small difference. It's only 0.0075 difference, days difference. This Gregorian calendar was implemented because at some point of time, quite early, to be exact, around 150 years after Julius Caesar, they already recognized that there's something wrong with their calendar. The days are moving, beginning of spring moves in the calendar, and the day and night similarity, the equinox is not on the exact correct day anymore. So right. they started to wonder what is the reason for this error, and they took an awful lot of time to finally figure it out, and in the 1583, they corrected the calendar, they switched to the Gregorian calendar, and making the year now 365.2425 days long. By doing this correction at that time, they calculated the amount of error days which were which totaled up on these within the running time of the Julian calendar, which was 1628 years, when I remember it right.
Okay.
And the multiplication of this small error, 0.0075, multiplied with the number of years when the Julian calendar was running, gives you an amount of 12.2 something days, which has had to be corrected. Astonishingly, they corrected only 10 days at that time,
right.
Which you will perhaps find in some lexicon and encyclopedias, but mostly they are speaking there about 10 days, but they're not speaking about the real number, the correct number, which would be 12.2 something. They overjumped these 10 days, so they corrected the starting point of spring and autumn. So astronomically, everything was done right. But mathematically, there's a big error. These 12 point something days, they had to correct, but they only corrected 10, gives you a difference of 2 point something days. That's not much, 2 days. Why do you worry about 2 days? So these 2 days stand for a multiplication of a yearly difference of 0.0075 days. That gives you around 300 years, which you have to worry about. 300 years in our calendar, which that shouldn't be there because of the astronomical situation, but which are there because of the mathematical situation. Mm-hmm. This made a German author called Heribert Illig writing a book called The Invented Middle Age. Das erfundene Mittelalter in German.
Mm-hmm. When did he write that? When did he write that?
20 years ago.
So oh, right, okay. Recent. I'm not okay, sure. Yeah, recent. That's all I was just trying to check. Yeah.
So he had the theory that somebody just before the Pope Gregor with the new calendar, the Gregorian calendar came up, invented 300 years in our timeline, mm-hmm. probably those years which might have little evidence in documentation or in archaeological findings. And with this theory, there was of course a big cry in the landscape of all historical professors, universities, etc., because it couldn't be. It simply couldn't be. Those history professors build their careers on Karl the Great, for example, and this Heribert Illig, this author, said Karl the Great never lived. It's all an invention.
Yes.
the book is fascinating to read because Heribert Illig seems to be a professional guy regarding artists, paintings, sculptures, etc., and buildings, architecture. So he is very professional in telling this building comes from this decade and this century, and this painting or this sculpture comes from that century. And he found very many artifacts and artists, paintings, buildings, etc., which simply could not be located in the year where they were located by historians. His book
is very
fascinating.
Confusing. This is very confusing.
His book is extremely interesting to read because you are nearly forced to follow his argumentation, because it's his conclusions are simply correct.
Okay.
However, yeah. he was wrong. he was wrong because the Gregorian calendar did only fix an error which we obviously had in our calendar.
Yeah.
But this error is not a constant error, but it's a flexible error, and it's declining day by day, year by year. But the people didn't know that. So let us go now back to the Julian calendar. They started the Julian calendar because there was a
so
calendar Juli- before.
So the Julian this. Calendar is Pope Julian, is that right?
No, Julius Caesar.
Ah, Julius. Oh, right. It comes after him. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And they started this calendar because the calendar which they had before didn't work well. So why didn't the calendar before this calendar work well? Well, because they had already a change in the orbit of the Earth, and their counting of the year wasn't correct, wasn't accurate with the calendar they had. And,
right.
and when we go back now in the history of calendars, we find a lot of different calendars on our planet. We have the Julian calendar, we have the Maya calendar, and Chinese calendars. And when we go back, let's say, minimum 2,000 years, we suddenly find lots of calendars having 360 days. Some of those calendars are, let's say, short-time calendars where they had 355 days or 364 days. So it was moving constantly, perhaps in a period where the orbit wasn't stable enough or where they were not yet right sure about what the real length could be. Because they had to adopt their measuring to the actual situation of planet Earth.
You know, when we think about solstices, I mean, here we are, this is March the 21st. So either today or yesterday, this is my layman's understanding. I haven't jumped into this to the degree, obviously, that you have, which is great, you being here, going through this, it's wonderful. But I understood that yesterday or today, round about now, the amount of daylight in the day is equal to the amount of darkness in the day. But I guess that would depend on what part of the Earth you're in. But here, it's synonymous with that. So we've gone through the spring equinox. We're on our way to the summer one, where the daylight will be considerably greater than the darkness. Then we will hit the autumn equinox, where it's equal again. And then, of course, we go back to more darkness. Now, if they're measuring the length of the year, is there one day on which they know that the sun is going to be in exactly the same place that it was last year, and their calculations were based on that? Is that how it works today? You can go, well, And then you find that your days are wrong. You go, well, this is the day, but actually it's not the same date as we had last year. Is that how the error began to be discovered? How did they discover that they were in error with their dates? Okay. 355 is way shorter than 365, isn't it? It's 10 days. So yeah. I imagine the sun's going to be all over the shop in the sky.
Well, I'm not very sure about the very detail which made them look up and say, hey, is something wrong here? I would guess that it's about the equinox, the spring equinox, for example, where they could measure exactly this is the amount of daylight, this is the amount of nighttime, so this is equal, and perhaps this is the most easiest part to measure. And if this day is not the 21st of March, then there's something wrong.
Right. Right, because we get quite giddy yesterday, you know, talking about the weather. It was beautiful here yesterday. So I'm out for a walk, taking my wife for a walk, and everyone was smiling. So I kept saying to everybody that I met, you're smiling. They went, yes, and everybody was smiling because the sun was out. It was a beautiful day. It's got nothing to do with what you've been talking about, but that was my day yesterday. It was really rather pleasant, actually. We're affected deeply by it. But the idea of detecting that somehow your calendar is out of whack by 5 or 10 days a year, that's bizarre. And to me it is. Of course, the other thing I was reading about is, are we not now at the first month of the year? Is this not the first? Because if there are 13 months, isn't April, it means the arrival, doesn't it? The advent of things, spring, the start of the year. Of course, we've had it shifted round to January the 1st. But if you look at the names of the months, which sometimes one does, they're kind of telling you what the actual number of the month is. So September is 7. October is 8. November, Nerf, is the 9th month, apparently. December, Diciembre, decimal, is the 10th, which would be 11th month, apparently. February the 12th, and March the 13th, and there's a month missing somewhere. We've also, August as well is just named after August, isn't it? Augustus. He got a month named after him. It's a good job he wasn't called Kevin or something. Not that I'm against anybody that's called Kevin, right? But it just wouldn't kind of look right. You know, it's kind of a grand name, isn't it? I don't have a month named after me. Have you got one named after you, Thomas? There isn't one, is there?
Unfortunately,
I want
no.
my own bloody month. If he well, can
Kevin
have one,
would
why can't
nice
we
idea.
Have one? You know.
First of Kevin, yeah. Let us go back to these older calendars. The Earth had calendars with 360 days, and the reason for the people at that time having a calendar with 360 days for many hundreds or even thousands of years is simply that the Earth had an orbit of 360 days. That's it. They didn't have 365.
Right.
So we have to look at the fact that the orbit changed at some point of time. And because it changed, the people suddenly started to have new calendars. The Maya calendar, for example, developed over many decades. And they had a period of 360 days and 5 days of bad luck, which they called it. And this period went over nearly 100 years.
Yeah.
Where they had... a special rhythm within this yearly rhythm that was, when I remember it right, 13 years. And every 13 years, this is the origin of the bad luck number 13, there was a big a planetary-sized moon coming very, very close to Earth.
Right.
And in a size, you can imagine something like you're looking out of the window and from horizon to horizon, there's only one moon in that size.
That's pretty big, isn't it?
Pretty big,
that's pretty,
yeah.
Do you have any idea? I know we're saying a long time ago. Are we talking thousands or tens of thousands of years ago that this event happened?
We are probably talking about less. That is quite amazing because when you normally talk about, let's say, archaeological time frames, you're talking about tens of thousands of years. And of course, when you're talking about dinosaurs dying out, the normal scientific number is 65 million years. It was
I remember that one
back in time. But when we're looking at the situation that the Earth's orbit has changed because of whatever incident, we have to look at, let's say, tools which were able to provoke such a change in the Earth's orbit. And this is obviously something very, very big hitting the Earth. There's no other possibility that the Earth's orbit would change just by coincidence or
yes.
because it liked to do is change. So we are talking in exactly about a moon which hit the Earth. And in my book, I present also the maps exactly where this happened. It happened minimum three times. One of the impacts was where now we have the Himalaya, the biggest mountains on Earth.
Okay.
The other very huge impact was the reason for the big flood, which happened in the south of South America, where we used to have a land bridge to Antarctica, which is now gone. It's pushed away, pressed away into the deep ocean, which you can very good take a look at in my book. And also, if you have a nice with bigger geographical maps, you will find that.
Yes.
So when you have...
There's a little question floated in here from Warren. It actually prompted something I was going to think about or was going to suggest. I would imagine this, let's call it a theory. I mean, you know a great deal more about it because you're talking about it from a knowledge base or having studied and read it. Let's just call it a theory for now, and forgive me for that. Does it wind up people who are kind of committed to the idea of the Earth being flat? Is it a problematic theory for people that are subscribing to that particular view of the cosmos?
Well, let's say everything I'm talking about here is for the moment based on the accepted fact that the Earth is round. I of course know the theory and the construct the thought or the thought construct of this Earth being flat.
Yeah.
But everything what is here in this argumentation is based on the fact that the Earth is round.
Yes, I've mentioned before, just to let you know, right? So one does, I should imagine you do, and maybe many of the listeners do, get drawn into that discussion. It's just come up over the last 5, 6, or 7 years with people saying the Earth's flat. I'm going, okay, you know, I don't really mind, actually. I think there are actually other more pressing matters, although I'm not saying it's not without interest. I personally find some of the questions are absolutely brilliant. I love the questions. I'm not necessarily convinced always about the answers, but I think some of the questions and some of the observations and some of the physical experiments they've done with lasers over large stretches of supposedly flat water, you know, if water levels everywhere, how big is this planet if it's that big? But I'm going to tell you what my little rejoinder is. It's this, because I got this from somebody else who at some point in the future I'd like to get on as a guest. Although we wouldn't really talk about this all the time, but I was talking to him several years ago about this. He's a pilot as well. He's in his 80s and he's military trained in a very specialized area of the military. And that's putting it mildly. He's an astonishing character, actually. And I said to him, I said, John, he said, yes. I said, is the Earth flat? He went, no. He said, it's round. He said, but it doesn't spin. And I love this because it gets me out of being placed on either side of the argument. So that's what I say to people. So I said, well, everything's going around the Earth. He went, yeah, that's a good one. it can't be like that. Well, I don't know. It's really interesting. And I came across, there's a professor, a really knowledgeable guy in the States whose name I don't have to hand. I saw a clip about his work maybe about 8 or 9 months ago. He's done an enormous book about why the Earth is at the center of things and doesn't spin. So I went, oh, this is interesting. I haven't got the book, of course, because I'm just too busy, but I'll maybe one day. And he said he was doing calculations on energy fields. And he said, yeah, the whole of the universe exists to keep this planet. All the energy is required to keep this thing absolutely still. I'm not saying I subscribe to that, but I do find it wonderful, the richness of ideas and questions that come through on this point. So
I can follow you with the argumentation. What troubles me every time when I'm thinking about flat Earth theory is when I take a look at the map of the Earth in the UN, United Nations logo.
Yeah.
When you take a look at that logo, you have exactly what the people are talking about, the North Pole in the center, and the land, the area of the continents going 360 degrees around it, and exactly in the size they really do have.
Yeah.
When you take a look at let's say school books and the world map which we have in school books, the size of the continent shown on this normal world map is completely wrong. It's misleading. Greenland is by far too big on these maps. Canada is by far too big on these maps. Russia is by far too big on these maps. And Africa is by far too small on this map.
Oh boy. And it's pretty big on the maps already, isn't it?
It's very, yeah, but it's very by far too small. When you you can use navigation software like Google Maps, there's a special tool on Google Maps which I don't recall the name. Just a second, I look it up. It's
the maps are fascinating. Stints. You know, on my desk right now, literally, I've just picked it up because I was flicking through it the other day, but not on this topic. I've got a book called Critical Path by Buckminster Fuller. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And Fuller did some amazing things with maps. I've forgotten the name of his map. It's just, he's done a map. It's not square, this thing. I can't put it up on the... I'll have to get these things prepped, really, for Rumble. We could always do screenshots of this stuff. So I maybe need to plan ahead a little bit more going forward. But he said pretty much what you said. But his thing was from a political point of view. He said, if you go to any particular country in the world and look at the map of the world in that particular country is always overemphasized in the map. So I grew up, of course, looking at Britain being right at the centre of the world, and everything revolved around us, you know, because we're British, and that's how it went. So that's what English school kids saw on the maps in school. And then he was informing, well, in France, it's France that's the biggest one, and maybe in Germany, you're much, much bigger on your maps. But he came up with a map. I've forgotten the name of it now. And it's irritating because I just looked at it, I couldn't find the name of it. It folds out, and it's what he says is a completely accurate view of the world. And when you look at it, it changes your thinking about where we live. I mean, it does. It's a very odd-looking thing. It produces a sort of tetrahedron. When you fold it all up, you can glue it together, and you produce this sort of shape with the whole thing. And Fuller's an absolute fascinating guy in terms of the quality of his questions. Tremendous stuff. But, okay, so Africa's not big enough on the maps. Okay, is that a worry? I don't know what to say.
I just looked up the name. It's Google Maps distance calculator.
Okay.
When you calculate that, the distance, for example, from Moscow to Siberia or from New York to Los Angeles or from Nairobi to Conakry. When you take a look at the map and then get the result in kilometers or miles,
yeah.
And then when you then compare this, for example, to the same distance shown in Greenland, you see at once that Greenland on the map is by far too big, and Africa is nearly 50% only of its real size.
Right.
It's amazing how the picture of the world then changes.
It does. It does. I haven't thought about this topic for a long time. I mean, I've had this book by Fuller since about 1980-odd or something. How sad. It's still in good nick, actually. Yes. Yeah, I actually quite like the flat Earth discussions, but I'm not a flat earther. But then I'm really open to people questioning. They go a bit cross. Some people get very, very cross about this and say that it is. But, of course, it taps into all these kind of myths about where we live. You mentioned Antarctica. You mentioned the land bridge. I was watching something the other day about, obviously, supposedly the events at the close of World War II with regards to U-boats going down to Antarctica. And I think that's
another fascinating story. But let us talk.
Yeah, okay, we'll come to that a bit
about
later.
The second.
I know, I'm jumping ahead.
Let us first talk about the second. So when we have an orbit being changed by an impact of a very big moon-sized object colliding with Earth, then the Earth gets an impulse. It changes its changes its rotating speed. It is pushed away a little bit more far away from the sun in this case, and it's not very stable in the beginning, but as in every physical system, the system stabilizes over the time, and after some years, the new orbit is stable. So this is what happened also to Earth. So we had an Earth orbit of 360 days, then there was a big impact. The Earth was wobbling a little bit around for several days, toggling from right to left, from south to north. The north and south pole changed at that time.
Yes, yeah.
And then it became stable again, but with a different orbit. We then didn't have 360 days, but 365 point something.
Yes.
And we also had a different day length because the rotation speed rose a little bit. And from that moment on, even the time measurement on planet Earth was different. This is the reason why our original Earth's second used to be longer than the second we have today. So this might be something artificial to discuss, and it doesn't change today anything of your daily routine. Rather a scientific discussion which nobody might see
it's
a reason for.
It's gripping stuff because it indicates, these things always indicate how easy it is to lose a sense of the truth through the mists of time. You were talking then about things reversing. I'm sure I've seen like etchings or reliefs, whatever you would call them, from Egypt, it may be even older than that, which show, according to our perspective, the sun rising in the west and setting in the east. Is that part of this process?
Yeah, there is a temple in Egypt showing the exact Milky Way, the exact sky which we see it now, but exchanged by north and south, which we have to, in opposite to today. So in the let's call it Egyptian time, for let's say 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago, there used to be a situation where this pharaoh saw something else in the sky than we do today.
Yes.
He saw exactly the south in our north today, and the north in our south today, and he let this sky picture painted in his temple, and therefore we can assume, at least, perhaps this pharaoh reminded this sky somehow by perhaps his grandparents told him about it. Maybe.
Yes.
It was even 200 or 300 years ago. Maybe. But it surely is not tens of thousands of years ago. So
no.
The change of this orbit, quite sure, has been done, let's say, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. This is a nice coincidence. Exactly the number of years in the Jewish calendar, the number of years the world exists. from that time until today.
Yeah.
So when we are looking at this old situation, and when we have an older Earth with another second length, with physical laws which exist only here on Earth and perhaps in the orbit around Earth, and all these original physical laws are based on the original length of the second, because they are born together with the planet. And now, after this incident where the Earth's orbit has changed, our second length has changed, and we do all our calculations with our new second. And we do scientific research in physics, in chemistry, in whatever, with this second. And the second is very important, because when we are talking about scientific research, we are mostly all the time speaking about frequency, and frequency is swing per second. And when we have a longer second originally here on Earth, 1.03 times longer than our second is today, we are talking about more swings per second. That would be a higher frequency in mathematical numbers than we would have today. what you do, for example, with your music files. We have now, let's
say... It's not me, it's the wizard in the background, it's the other Paul.
And the wizard. Your wizard does.
My alter ego.
The wizard. for example, if we play a classical piece of classical music with an orchestra being tuned on 440 hertz, and you tune it back on 432 hertz, you go back to a slower movement,
yes,
with a lesser number in frequency. So perhaps when we then start to discuss about the original second being longer,
yeah,
the original second could have had a frequency of 440, but being played in the speed you are doing with the now 432 hertz. That's a little bit confusing, I know, but we are talking about physical laws which we try to examine today with the wrong length of a second. And what we already learned, even with this wrong length of a second, is that nature almost every time shows us very simple equations, very simple numbers. Let's say there's a law with 1/10 of this equals 1 part of that, or a half of this equals 4/4 of that time, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And when we when we could perhaps force at least some of our scientists to try to research on the basis of our original second length, then perhaps we can find out some more secrets of physics of our planet.
Yes. Of course, I am struck by the idea that, as far as I know, for example, the Roman centurions and the legions, none of them in there had a pocket watch, did they? I know I'm being silly, but when were the first mechanical timepieces? I mean, maybe there were things. I know I've seen them discover artifacts from these sunken ships in Greece, these certain odd-looking, what were obviously machines of a sort, some type. Yet did they measure the second 5,000 years ago? How would they actually measure it? And also the other question is, how do they measure it today? If you're building it's quartz, isn't it? Apparently some digital thing. But how do you measure? Do you have a measuring thing to measure that your thing that's running at a second has been measured correctly? Yeah. I'm getting confused here.
these basic definitions are, for example, for a meter, we have the 40 thousandths parts of the Earth's...
right.
How do you call it?
Circumference?
The length of the equator.
Yeah. Yeah, the circumference, yeah. So, all the way around.
So one meter is the 40,000th part of it. And the second used to be defined as the 86,400th part of a normal middle day, summer day length.
Right.
So it used to be connected to nature. At the moment, since many decades already, we have another definition for the second, completely disconnected from nature. There is a certain, I think it was a cesium atom or cesium isotope in a very specific state with a very specific temperature, and then you have to measure the 1 million whatever part of the swings it does in a certain time frame. So it's completely disconnected from nature. It's very stable. You can do your calculations with it. You can build computers with it. You have a very good basis for a worldwide length of a time,
yeah,
frame, which you can use for machines, computers, measuring, meeting, whatever you need in supermarkets or in petrol
food
stations,
we need in those,
wherever you
we?
Want to measure time,
yes,
you can do it.
Prior to the metric system, the metric system, who do we blame for that? Is it Napoleon to blame for the metric system? The meter, the kilometer, the kilogram?
The kilogram, kilogram, yeah.
Yeah. So prior to that, prior to the arrival of that, in Germany, what did you, what was your unit of measurement? We have had feet and inches here and yards. I'm still happier with imperial measurements. First of all, imperial is just a nicer word than metric. Secondly, all the names of all the measurements in metric things are very long, multi-syllable things, whereas we have things like inch, foot, yard, mile. It's much, I just find it much. And also there's this thing going back to the cubit. So you were talking there about the measurements around the circumference of the Earth, but isn't there something with regards to cubits? Maybe this is pre-something smashing into the Earth, that the cubit, which is, what, roughly from the elbow to the knuckle or something, is about 18 inches approximately on a reasonably proportioned human being.
Perhaps it's the English word for elle. I just look it up, mm-hmm. because elle is one very important... No, it's L. Ellen's in English.
Right.
It's from the elbow to the hand. This used to be a very famous tool or measurement tool also in Egypt.
Yes, I know. There's a lot in there, isn't there? I mean, the inch is supposedly the last phalanx of the thumb, although I've got massive hands, right? And my thumb's about an inch and a half. It's rubbish compared to my normal measuring thing. But it's interesting how these measurements came around. And maybe there was a measuring system prior to inches and feet and yards and all that kind of stuff. We tend to, I just think sort of genetically, the British think better in yards and inches. But then when I speak to my sons, they don't know what I'm talking about. And they keep talking to me about centimetres. Four syllables, you see, to describe such a little thing. And millimetres. And anyway, I'm being slightly prattling on about this kind of stuff. But that whole... You're just reminding me of things that I was looking at, well, quite a few years back now. I've still got the books somewhere sitting on my shelf, but they've kind of faded out. They're not in the prominent part of my brain. But going through this, it's really bringing it all back. Are you familiar with a guy called, or know of a guy called Velikovsky? I've forgotten his first name.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. He's mentioned a few times in my books, yeah.
Is he? Right, okay. So fantastic. So I've got a couple of things by Velikovsky, and one of them, very interesting, Mankind in Amnesia, is a very interesting mm-hmm. book in terms of he's talking about, actually, he could be talking about now, really. he could easily be talking about now because, you know, we see huge chunks of mankind in Amnesia. He was talking about these catastrophic events that are indicated in the record, saying that they were so catastrophic, they decimated and destroyed so much stuff that people couldn't really remember it. They became, it's almost as if a big line went through their head because it was just such a horrific loss of everything that they'd known and that they were in a state of amnesia from that point forward. But I would also add, much of his work is based on an extremely arresting English writer called Cummins Beaumont. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
He's definitely worth looking up. Cummins Beaumont, actually, this doesn't start good when I tell you what he was. He worked on Fleet Street as a newspaper journalist in the late 10s, 1920s. But after that, he devoted himself to looking at these events, the study of maps, the locations, historical records. It became his life's work. And he wrote some books with incredibly arresting titles from a British point of view. I think Velikovsky retrieved, let me use that word, a great deal of his sort of study field from Beaumont. And they are amazing books. They really are amazing. I mean, there are things to do with the Bible, where he goes through the Bible, he says that these events could not have taken place in that part of the world that you think they took place in. He goes through certain sort of parts of scripture where apparently they're in a town and they go and get some fish. Well, if it was there, the fish is like 800 miles away. You can't get any. There's all sorts of things that don't add up. I'm being very fast as I say this. It's obviously something that we would have to study or go through in a little bit more detail. But his books are, I think you would find them very interesting. There's about five or six of them. The last one was not published in his life. It's called The Great Deception, I think, if I remember. And I've got a copy of it on PDF somewhere. And it's about the rewriting of history to move things around, primarily often for political power purposes, you know, so that someone could claim they were the king of these lands and this is how big it was and you better pay more attention to me because of that, etc., etc. But it's wonderful work, and you can see the root of much of the modern discussion, if that's what you want to call it, of flat earthism and these other views of our environment. Beaumont's a major figure in that, even though he's not very well known these days.
Yeah, what Wilikowski did, if he mentioned or he read probably all these books and then took what he read and did his own research on top of it, I think I did something very similar, because of course what I wrote in my books is not everything what I found out. I just read a lot and put those things together and made my own research on top, as probably very many researchers do.
Yes.
And what Willick, for example, Heribert Illig had this theory of the invented Middle Age. I corrected him with a complete chapter and proved that he was wrong. His theory is brilliant, and most of the things he found out are really dated not correctly.
Yes.
However, his assumption that 300 years were invented somehow and placed into our timeline is wrong.
Right.
I can prove it with ancestry and with also the calculation of the time length, the year length changing over the decades. Let's go back to the Julian calendar. So they had this Julian calendar where they measured very accurate the length of our year, and with the result 360 days 0.245 days, 365.25. They went on and this calendar worked great.
Yep.
However, not their measurement was wrong, but the year length changed after that. After they implemented the Julian calendar, the Earth, let's say, wants to go back to Mama, and the stable system of the Earth's orbit after this incident wasn't that stable. So the Earth's orbit still is changing now and still wants to go back to the original situation. This is the reason why the Gregorian calendar then suddenly measured 1600 years later a different year length.
Yeah.
With this very small difference, and this difference gets smaller every year. With every volcanic eruption, it gets a small hit and gets even smaller then.
This great wallop or series of wallops that the Earth received, according to this view, or looking at it from that thing, are they in part responsible for the wobbling of the Earth on its axis, which leads to the precession of the equinoxes? Is that something that didn't... Was it perfect? Do you think it was perfectly stable and happy at 360 days a year until some great force of the universe came along and buckled it over?
I assume that the Earth's orbit was not the only thing that changed, but also the position of the Earth's axis changed. It changed by around 23 degrees. And the Earth used to have a very stable, very vertical position in its orbit, which we don't have today, because now we have this summer-winter rhythm. We have not a vertical Earth axis, but slightly changed,
yep.
Which is on top also wobbling. Yes, so the incident is responsible for most part of all this.
I mean, we're familiar with these phrases from script, you know, the fall of man and the fall of the Garden of Eden, the loss of something that we view in the past as being as close to perfection as we could envisage, you know, an abundance of food and happiness and contentment or whatever you want to call it. And do you think that this event is part of that? I mean, I remember seeing, I can't remember his name again, a professor from Texas. I saw this, his video will still be kicking around. And he was talking about the firmament, which is seen to be, or has been described as, this great body of water protecting the Earth in the Earth's
yeah.
atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that it, what it protected us from was ultraviolet rays. So, and then he had done some calculations, because he was a religious studier, but also a physicist. And so it's a very compelling presentation, very, because he's pulling two worlds together. And I know people do this to try and, supposedly from the skeptic's point of view, justify things that can't be justified. However, I'd have to dig it up and pull it out. But what he was talking about, he said, we've calculated how thick this layer of water was and what would have happened on the Earth. And his view was, or the the theory that he was pitching, and this is to do, I think, also in our bones about living for a long time. He said, what would have happened is that because of this body of water around the Earth, the air pressure in underneath this water, between the water and the Earth's surface, was much higher than it is today. And because it was high, it was also massively saturated in oxygen. There was way more oxygen in the atmosphere than there is now. And he was looking at some record of a shark from about, he said, about 50 million years ago, according to the instruments that they had. This shark was about 5 to 10 times bigger than a shark of today. And what he was suggesting, he said, because of this massive increase in air pressure, everything, absolutely everything in the plant world, in the animal world, was bigger. Much, much bigger. And he made this wonderful sort of thing. He said the atmosphere was so full of oxygen that if you'd been alive then, you'd be able to run for 3 hours and not be out of breath because your body was just saturated with it. You'd never. I thought, now that would be useful, wouldn't it? Well, that would be quite useful to just go and go and go. But it kind of touched on these myths of, you know, now we move into giants and all the ancient architecture and these things as well. This sense that there's something massive. There's probably multiple civilizations and ages down here. That's what I tend to think.
So I can only say that he's exactly correct. In my book, I show a picture of a metal, an iron hammer.
Yep.
This iron hammer was found within a natural stone. So it's very old. It was surrounded by a completely natural stone. And when they examined this hammer made of iron, they found out that this sort of iron cannot be produced on our Earth today. It can only be produced under nearly double pressure.
Right.
So it was exactly produced at that time when the Earth had a coat of let's say a kilometer thick water. Around the complete planet. And when this incident happened and when this moon-sized object came closer to Earth, at some point of time, this outer water coat was destroyed. And then it started to rain on Earth. 30 days. It was raining all the time, everywhere.
Yeah.
That is the basis of all these old stories.
And what do you think this would go to, in some way, explaining, not that I'm looking for an explanation of it, but there's an according to the maps, yet again, we're beginning to question everything. We don't even know where to begin the sentences. But according to the maps of the world, apart from the fact that Africa's not big enough, every time I look at one, I am struck, of course, by the sheer amount of ocean that there is, the amount of water down here. Obviously, it's in the oceans. Is it likely that the fall of this firmament, this body of water, is part and parcel of why the oceans are so vast on this planet, and that water at some point was suspended above us, acting as some kind of protective shield?
Yes, and perhaps I should add that I assume that all the water on Earth used to be sweet water. And the reason why we have salt water today is simply this incident where this moonside object hit the Earth and then made a terrible devastation here down on Earth where millions or even billions of tons of stone and minerals were flooded into the oceans.
Yeah, it's hard to envisage, really. It is. It's hard to envisage. But it seems to many of these myths that are recorded, as we said, you know, in these reliefs and in these carvings, seem to indicate this. And, of course, every single culture that we know of has their own flood myth. There is the talk of this great flood. We have that the Earth was wiped out. What's that character that went to South? Quetzalcoatl. What a name. I couldn't even pronounce it when I first started reading that. I don't know. Listen, so there's a man arrives called Quetzalcoatl on a boat, and of course they, because he came out of the sea, they have him as a god, and they often portray him as a fish, don't they, or with a fish hat. Is this where, and the all of this stuff, which leads through to the Pope with the Pope's hat, which is basically a fish on his head, isn't it? It's not really a fish. It looks like a fish, but yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, it's sparking all sorts of things off here in my head about all that stuff. Somebody had written earlier that they thought the Bible was basically a big psyop. Maybe everything's a psyop. Maybe the truth is a psychological operation and you've got to try and figure it out and work it all out. I think it's, you have to be very careful when you're reading these things. What's that thing? Of the making of many books, there is no end. So it requires some kind of a, one has to, I think, tap into what you consider to be your instinct about certain lines of truth or inquiry to come to some sort of a view of, well, you know, to be less wrong today than you were yesterday. That's really my goal. That's all I can say. I don't know whether anybody's truly accurate totally about all these things. We've been talking an hour, Thomas. Do you know that? We've been talking for an hour.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, perhaps I can add something. When you're doing research today, you often find lies. You can identify a lot of lies. Very simple, in fact, when you do the calculations about whatever is told in some history book and you find out that it can't be because the maths are wrong, then you already identify the lie. The problem is you don't know the truth. You only know that what you just read is a lie. And you have to find a whole lot of lies to have at least an idea of what might be the truth behind all those lies.
Yes. Yeah. We had you brought a couple of tunes last week, of which we played just the one. And you've sent a couple more in, and we're an hour in, so it's nice to play something. And you asked me to ask you a question about one. Now, the long one is probably a bit too long. It's nearly 9 minutes. I think it would take up a bit too much time. So which one would you like me to play, if you tell me? Which one?
If you don't like the long one, then go to the first one of last week, which we didn't have last week.
Okay, which was... Now I'm going to muller the German language. Oh, the one we played last week was Preludio, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that Vivaldi or Verdi? I can't remember now.
That was Verdi, the overture to La Traviata.
Okay. So.
And what we hear now should be Mozart.
3 minutes long. Great. Say it. Yeah, that one. We're gonna take a 3 minute break, everybody. Recharge your batteries. Go outside and have a look. You might think you live on a flat earth. Maybe you do. It's probably not true.
Perhaps before we send all the people away just to hear some classical piece of music. Don't go away. What you will hear is probably the best female singer with the aria of the Queen of the Night of the Magic Flute of Mozart. I listened to that around 30 years ago, just on radio, and I was so fascinated by her voice that I searched for many weeks because I didn't know anything. I didn't know her name. I didn't know who the conductor was. I knew nothing. And finally, I found a compact disc with this recording, and since then, I'm a great fan of her. So have fun listening.
Let's play this. Here we go. 3 minute break.
Oh, Attention all listeners, are you seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 Talk Radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil and stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Hour 2. Well, slightly less than Hour 2. We've just gone over the midpoint there. I'm here with Thomas Anderson. You're on Paul English Live. We're on WBN every Thursday, usually 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, but 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. for this week and next week. Kind of appropriate that we've been talking about time and the adjustment of time and the fact that down here on the earth we can't all do it at the same time, and that's really the way things are. Thomas, that was marvelous. I didn't know what I was listening to until we got to that ridiculous bit in the middle, and then I'd heard that many times before. You gave the backstory on that piece of music, but what's it from? Is that from a bigger work? It must be.
It's the Magic Flute. The composer is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The singer
who
is Christine. who the fuck?
Who's he?
Whatever.
Yeah.
The singer is Christina Deutekom. It's a recording from, I think it was in the 1970s, with George Scholte. And I think it was London Symphony Orchestra, but I'm not very sure. But George Scholte is the conductor. So if anybody wants to go for and buy this recording, it's Christina Deutekom and George Scholte.
Magic Flute. Wow. Highlights. I think I'm going to have to go and listen to the whole thing. I'm going to have to go. You see,
I never ever heard any female singer doing it this accurate.
Yeah, it's transportive. This is this thing about music and sound, frequency. It is the language of the higher realms. There's no two ways about it. It must be, you know. Was it Plato that warned us severely about music? I think it was Plato, wasn't it? You got to watch out for that music, he said. So, he didn't say it like that, of course, but its power to move us is astonishing. That was... you can see I'm a bit of an ignoramus. You see, when it comes to opera and things like that, I actually went to see an opera years ago. In, where was it now? It wasn't Vienna. I can't remember where I went now. It was somewhere in Europe. Look at that. And I can't even remember the name of the opera. So what a dope. No, I can't remember it. But it was, it's quite an event. I can see it's you know, they had opera and churches in the past. I mean, do you think that music's improved since then, Thomas? What do you think? Do you think it's better? Do you think it's got better since then?
Absolutely no.
I tend to agree.
When you when you understand music, how it works, how music is composed and can be composed, then yeah, you understand how notes can be put together, and notes work in accords in different combinations. And the name of this, the name of these, are important. We have an octave, we have a terz, you know that.
Yep.
And you have exactly the same patterns in light. When you look at light frequencies, you have exactly the same patterns. You have octave, you have terz, you have harmonics, you have disharmonics. And you can go even deeper then, and you go to, in let's say, electrodynamics, you have exactly the same again.
Yes.
So when you understand music, you understand the universe.
You know, I was there's this, if you look at a piano, and obviously the lower notes are on the left and the higher notes are on the right. And I've sometimes, we have a piano in the house and my sons play it from time to time. I don't. I'm a doofus, but my wife used to play, and the piano's just sat around the house, and they often just sit down and play things from kind of memory or whatever. It's great. It's great. And yet I look at that range of notes, thinking about frequencies, and I'm thinking, okay, so I've got this lowest note on the left, but there's one below that, right, that the piano makers didn't put on. And then there's one below that. And in fact, that direction, I assume, just goes on to infinity, getting lower and lower and lower. Same with the other side, getting higher and higher and higher. And there is something about us being moved by higher frequencies. Obviously, it moves outside of the range of our hearing. But this thing about sensitivity, literally, that there's the light and the dark, and music communicates these things universally to all people, irrespective of whatever language we're currently employing, you know, to try and describe things. That whole, why is it that you just, you know, I can hear certain chord changes, and I'm not alone in this, and I just start to cry. I have no idea why. I just go, oh, it hits you. There's something. Why is that sad? It's not because somebody told you it was sad or that it was evocative or melancholic. It's very haunting, the idea that, you know, and maybe as Northern Europeans, we're kind of attracted to that. I don't know. You know, the sort of melancholic, I think of music for an autumn day, and I'm always very captivated by that. It seems as though it's resonant with meaning and echoes of history, all those sorts of things. Speaking of history, which of course we have been doing, and probably will keep talking about it forever, when we first spoke, I meant to bring this up last week, but I'm kind of glad I didn't, because I wanted to bring it up this week. You may recall, when we first spoke, after our mutual friend, reluctantly, after many months of grinding his teeth, said, oh, I'll put you two in touch with one another, which was very funny at the time. It was funny, because I don't know if you remember, he said, I shouldn't put you two together. I was going, why? He said, no, it'll be very, very bad. Of course, it turned out to be nothing of the sort. It was just that we were going to talk about things like this. Do you remember, I don't know when we, what we used, maybe it was Skype or something like that, and I was talking to you, and you did a screen share of your desktop at the time. It might not look like this now, but I'll never forget it, because you'd laid out your family tree. You must recall this, yes?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Okay. And, of course, I'm expecting to see things going back a few generations, but yours went back a little bit further than that, didn't it?
A little bit, yes.
How far did it go back? You need to tell the listeners how far it went back.
I will tell, but perhaps you let me tell the complete story.
Yes, I will.
I started quite early to be interested in such things. My grandfather was a painter, not for buildings, but for paintings, for mm-hmm. pictures. And I visited him only once in his atelier, in his working room there, and he showed me a family tree, which he painted about our family. And I was very surprised and very astonished and thrilled, because the oldest date which he got there was around 1200. So he got only a few names going down the direct line from my father, grandfather, his father, etc. But 1200, that's quite a big number. And yep. I had this picture. I took a picture of it with my camera, and I had this picture all the time with me. But I forgot the topic then, and when I was in my early 20s, I was interested again in this kind of information, and I asked my father, I asked my grandmother. My grandfather was already dead at that time, and I collected whatever I could get from both my mother's line and my father's line, and started to type that into my computer. Unfortunately, I started with an Apple Macintosh, which was a nice machine, but the software at that time wasn't very good, so I had all this data I collected within the Macintosh. Then mm-hmm. I switched on to a Windows PC, and I couldn't use the typed-in data. And it took me years until I finally found a software for the Windows PC that allowed me to import the old data, and I was simply too lazy to type that all again.
Good. So I'm glad to hear that.
I was very lucky, and I could import all the data. And the program I used gave me the chance to compare my data with the data of other researchers on the net. And when I then compared my data, let's say from the 1800 and 1700, there were some results popping up, giving me the chance to see, okay, this one, same year, same name, same family, same children, is the same person, great. And where I didn't have the parents of this person, another researcher had already the parents of this person. So I went on and went back generation after generation, going back 1700, 1600, 1500, and it was thrilling to find out all these names and family connections. And it took me around 10 years with lots of work doing within this program. And then the last half year was the most interesting. I started to find out what my grandfather already had with these years of 1200 something, and I could go even further into the past and landed at 1000, at 800, at 600, and I was thrilled. Wow, 800, that's really far away in the past. And then I went back to 200, 100, got Roman names. Roman names, wow, well, nice, yep. Nice thing. I could go back because the Roman names are well researched and you have lots of resources where you can find all the parents of whatever who was there, Caesar or a Roman emperor. And at some point of time, after these Roman names, I suddenly had Jewish names. And I was shocked.
Right.
I couldn't believe, well, Jewish name, that's not what I expected to find. And I went back, and suddenly, at some point of time, the name on the screen was Adam and Eva. I had to laugh.
Yes.
I couldn't believe what I read there. It kind of made everything what I have done ridiculous. Because at that point of time, I simply couldn't believe that this data could somehow be accurate.
Right.
But however, I researched it. So I checked every single name on that family tree name on that family tree again, and with different sources, with different websites, also offline with books where, for example, the line of Roman emperors were written down, and I checked everything, and I must say, according to the actual status of science, this family tree seems to be accurate.
Yes, I remember being rather impressed when I saw it on your screen. And there you go, there's Adam and Eve. Right. Right, said I remember. When you use the word...
The astonishing thing is, when you take a look at the family tree, which you saw only a very early version of this family tree.
It oh, grew right.
After
much better
I
now.
Had it on the laptop there.
Yeah.
When you take a look, and I arranged everything now very nice and accurate in a very vertical line going from Adam and Eve down to me, we are talking about Adam being my 119th grandfather.
Okay.
And 119th grandfather, that's not a big number.
Although, does your chart take into account these lost 300 years? You see,
I thought about that.
Maybe you're throwing a spanner into your own works there. I don't know quite what's going on, but yeah. And when you used the word, when you said Jewish names, were you referencing? Did you mean scriptural names, names from biblical records? Is that what you meant?
Yes, of course. When you go to Adam and Eve, the line of ancestors of Adam and Eve, of course, they are biblical names. It's mm-hmm. Methuselah and Seth, and there are a lot of them.
Mm. Although, not to bend the conversation away from this, but I would suggest that those names are not Jewish. I don't think it's particularly the right word.
You may be but when you go down a little bit, let's say 2,000 years, perhaps from Adam and Eve to in direction of our days today, in this family tree, there are a lot of kings of Judea, king of Judea, king of Judea, one after one, a complete line.
That's very interesting. I mean, that's absolutely not Jewish, by the way. So this is brilliant. Much more interesting to me than I at first thought. That's amazing. We've got another discussion to have with regards to that, but I don't think this is a show for it necessarily, because it'll open up a can of not just worms, but all sorts of other things. But that's fascinating. That really is. I'm kind of jealous. I don't know how you were able to do that. I mean, my dad did one for us, and I think he got back to about 1608 or something like that. My sister's got it somewhere. My son said, "Dad, have you got that thing yet?" I'm going, "No, I'll get a copy of her at some point." We just got as far back as tracing most of our family coming from, I think on my father's side, Norway. So we often say that we came from some fjord and we were eating fish for a long time, and we came from Norway or something like that.
And did you find any kind of noble family name there?
No, I'm a peasant. Yeah. We don't go in for that sort of thing. I'm from Yorkshire. We don't have any nobility up there. We just eat chips and things. So it's I don't think so. Of course, everybody's desperate to go, "Oh, look, we've got a king." So maybe haven't looked hard enough. I don't know. Maybe there is one in there. I'd like to think there was, but I'm not. I wouldn't hold my breath too long. But there's something gripping about it. I mean, as a race, do you think, are we the only people that tend to do this, or do other races really get stuck into trying to figure out their ancestry? Well, I don't know. You know, it's just a thought that just ran across my head. Then I wonder if other. I mean, I only know of our sorts of people that do it. I remember when I was growing up, even though it wasn't old. One of the as a small boy, surrounded by all my aunties and uncles, I had an awful lot. My mum was one of eight. So social gatherings when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, that kind of age, were really rich with a lot of chatter. And, of course, there'd be just tons of names come up. "Do you remember so-and-so?" "Oh, yes." "And wasn't that Auntie so-and-so?" I thought, who are all these people? I didn't know who they were. Of course, it's not as interesting as going all the way back to Adam and Eve. I'll give you that. But it did kind of entertain me a lot at the time, this sort of scope of families. And it's wonderful how passionate everybody gets about them. I had a cousin who couldn't stop asking questions about all these people that she didn't know. It's a real compulsion, or it was with her, and I certainly felt it as well. You'll have to get them printed up, you know. Maybe you could sell them as part of your book, you know. Chip in. We get a map of, to find out, who is the guy that wrote this book? Well, it goes back quite a way, you know. So... That's fascinating. That was wonderful, that. I remember that.
So the reason why I ask you about noble names is simply when you have some noble family names in your family tree, the chance is very big that you somehow find some data online there.
Yes. Yes. Well, I suppose I could pretend that I've got noble blood in me.
That would help.
It's difficult. I don't know. I mean, I'm very interested in these sort of stocks of people. You know, what is it? There's the Alpine. Then there is the... what's the other one? The Nordic. So it all depends. I don't know what my skull shape is, but I'm kind of familiar with the Nordic skull shape amongst our race. I know that. That's kind of like the highbrow ones, the ones that I consider to be very, very bright. I don't think I'm that. The Alpine were more doughty, sort of robust sort of people hopping around getting things done. But I'm probably just of Saxon stock. On my mum's side, we had everything in there. We had Welsh, Irish and Scottish blood. But on my father's side, he traced it back really to Norway, because where I'm from in Yorkshire, there was a big influx of Scandinavians into Yorkshire around, I think it was in the 1500s and 1600s. And that's why, I mean, I don't know if it's true now, but I know at the time there were a lot of blonde-haired people. Maybe there are across England, so I'm probably talking out my bum. But there were a lot of blonde-haired people there. And when I was born, I was blonde for a bit. My sister still is. I'm sort of gone all dark, you know, and scampish now, as most of us tend to do that. But it's fascinating seeing all these sort of strains of our different sort of racial clusters all coming together into different spaces.
Perhaps some of our listeners now have the idea that, well, when this guy has his family tree going back to Adam and Eve, that's the beginning. And so this guy obviously thinks that Adam and Eve were the first people on Earth. Perhaps at this point of discussion, I should add, no, I'm not. When I researched this family tree, I at one point of time I came to a researcher from Korea, and this guy wrote a book. Unfortunately, I couldn't read the book because it's in Korean language, and I couldn't buy it even. So, but I have the contact to him, and perhaps I someday will have the chance to speak to him. He wrote a book with a family tree of. I don't know if it was his family or another family. It was a Chinese family where Adam and Eve were in the middle of the timeline. So he went back double my time into the past, showing even much, much more data. And of course, the old Chinese resources about emperors' families are well researched and they are available even on paper today. So what I have here as a family tree shows, let's say, the origin of what we might call Middle East and Western population.
Yes.
It's not about Chinese population. It's not about Asian population.
No. I mean, I agree with you on the Adam and Eve thing. I think even scripture would agree with you on that because... is it not true that when Cain gets kicked out, he goes off and hangs around with other people? That's actually in the text. So you go, well, where'd they come from then? You know, we're not supposed to ask questions like that. No, but I have. I've just asked it. Where were they then? Who put them there?
We discussed this a lot. And when you mentioned the name Cain, of course, this is a very, very interesting detail of all this. When I wrote my first book, I recognize that history in our Western part of the world is very often about Jews and Germans. Somehow they're in every problem. Yeah. And I always wondered why this is so, and why there's all this trouble between Germans and Jews, and the trouble with Jews and the trouble with Germans. Everybody seems to have trouble with Jews. Everybody seems to have or has had trouble with Germans. I didn't understand that. So I try to find out. Of course, there's younger history with Hitler and all this, but that's not the reason. That's not the origin. And when you take a look at, for example, 1933, I think it was when Chicago Daily News, where the Jewish World Congress declared total war on Germany.
Yes.
I don't remember which newspaper Samuel it was exactly.
It was Samuel Untermeyer that was behind all that. But yes, 1933.
So they declared total war on Germany, but they didn't say Germany. They said Amalek. Who the fuck is Amalek? I didn't understand that.
You can say that, by the way. Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's fine. I said that word once too, and I apologize for it, but never again. But it's fine. Yeah, don't worry.
So I always wondered why they used this strange word Amalek.
Yes.
And when I was writing my book, I still came to the point where, damn, I have to find out this detail. Why is this so? Why didn't they say German or Germany, but they said Amalek? And I found out.
Yeah.
When you go back to this family tree, you go to Adam and Eve, you find out that there was somebody who created Adam. It's written in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And also Eve was created. And when you take a look at the Bible, in our today's version, it's written there that, depends on the version you get, they took a rib out of Adam and created Eve out of it. Something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So when you then try a so-called Dabar translation of the Bible, I only know that it's available in German language. It's even for free. Dab, D-A-B, and then the next word is H-A-R. Dabar.
Right.
In this translation of the Bible, it is not translated in let's say spoken language, but word by word. Not regarding if that makes any sense. It's just a translation word by word. And when you then go back to the original resources and translate it really word by word, then you can read they laid anesthesia on Adam. They took one of his cells, and out of this cell they created a female man, let's say, and they named them they named her Eva. So this is very scientific. This is surgical. Yes. This is medical, and it describes exactly what we are doing today. We're doing genetic manipulation out of cells, and when you take this word by word translation out of the Bible, well, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
We have this situation. They created Adam and Eve, and when you then take a look at Velikovsky, for example, you mentioned this name, and there are several others which are also named in my book as sources. You find out that Enki and Enlil, you are very well aware of these names, yes, were here on Earth, and let's call them Anunnaki. They landed here. They wanted to exploit this planet. They wanted to have the gold and perhaps also different other things. They created a sort of working race, working ape, working biological machine, robot, whatever. And they started with this Adam and Eve. And the two brothers seemed to had a fight and very tough discussion about how to go on with this working race. And the one had the opinion that they shouldn't be able to think a lot, they should work and not think. Yes. And the other had the opinion that it's about free will. When we are creating life, we must respect the free will, and therefore they should be able to think. And the two brothers got in a very bad fight about this, leading to the point where one of these brothers said, no, I don't want them to think. Let's finish the discussion now. It's done. And the other said, well, okay. And then secretly went to Eva and made her pregnant with his own semen.
Right.
And the offspring of this was Cain. So Cain was partly, let's say, genetically manipulated original human, and the other children. But Cain was then partly human and partly, let's say, goddish. He had gods or Enki's genes in it, mm-hmm, or in him, making him bigger, stronger, more intelligent, you name it. At some point of time, he murdered his brother. Perhaps he was angry, or he was angry about his stupidity. I don't know. However, he was then expelled from that area of the Garden of Eden and brought to the land of Nod, N-O-D.
Yes.
And with this old language which they spoke at that time, it doesn't matter how you put the letters together. You can make N-O-D or D-O-N, it doesn't matter. It's still the same word. So the land Nod became then Don, D-O-N, and out of D-O-N, became D-U-N. So the land of the Duni was ruled by Assur-bel-Kaini. Assur-bel-Kaini means Assur, the son of Cain, and Assur being the grandfather or the ancestor of all Assyrians. Assur-bel-Kaini was the king of all Dunites. So we are talking about Cain going out of Eden, starting his own land, his son Assur-bel-Kaini becoming the king of all Dunites. Out of these Dunites arose all the Assyrians. Out of the Assyrians, Aryans arose. Out of these Aryans later became all the Germans. So we are talking about a time, now we come to Amalek. Amalek was one of the cities where these Dunis settled down. And so the original situation which we had here with Cain being labeled as a murderer and put out, and on the other side the two brothers Enlil and Enki being very angry on each other, the one who was father to Cain didn't do anything, but the other one said, okay, we have to somehow get rid of this Cain and his offsprings, and therefore I will find some people who will do this for me. And the only people who followed his order was some people in the north, so it is written in the Bible. A very powerful people being then given all the powers, all the machines, all the wisdom of this Enki to be able to get rid of Cain and Amalekites, Amalek, and getting this job done.
Yes.
It's written in the Bible that there is war against Amalek from generation to generation until it's done, until Amalek is completely eradicated from the earth's surface. And this is the reason why in 1933 there was a war declared on Germany, but it was written, it's total war on Amalek. The Germans are the last descendants of this Amalekites and of Cain. This is what can be proven by this.
And where this, I don't agree with that, by the way. where did you get that information from? What's the source for that narrative? Where does that come from?
Many different sources. First of all, I started with this family tree, wondering why these names pop up at certain locations in this family tree.
Yeah.
Then it's the Bible. The word-by-word translation of the Bible. It's Velikovsky with everything what he has written down. It's a little bit like you identify a lot of lies in the Bible and elsewhere, and then try to sort out all these lies to lift the curtain to the right and to the left to take a look at the picture which was there originally on the table.
Yes. I have a different take on the narrative. I actually have a chart that I should send you. Can't really show showing all these different tribes. Because I would suggest it's the other way around, you see. I think the use of the word Amalek is a projection on to you, onto us, onto our extended races, by Amalek himself. I think so. I'm saying right now there is another deception. That's my view. I'm always open to having it changed. Not much, I suppose. But that's what I think is taking place. So when I have to send you this little chart showing you the line from Cain into Edom and Esau and where Amalek comes in. And so when they talk about annihilating and destroying Amalek utterly, the Amalekites, I am suggesting that they're actually talking ultimately about destroying themselves, for they are Amalek. And this is why they've projected that, to disguise it onto the people that are supposed to get rid of Amalek. They're saying, you're the bad guy. No, hang on. And the old projection trick. You're just about to be accused of murder, so you accuse your would-be accuser of being the murderer before he can even get the words out of his mouth. And but it's for another discussion, is that? I mean, the Enki and Enlil thing, I've read that years ago, and I haven't even thought about it. There were some very compelling arguments in it. The idea that they were having an argument, and this would explain, at least it suggested, the kind of odd, what it suggested was the odd behavior of Yahweh, in that he creates these creatures and then gets very cross with them.
Use the word Yahweh, it seems to me when I read all the sources that J H WH is not a name, it's a title. It's something like admiral or captain. The man of the 50.
Yeah.
I think it's the leader of the 50. So it's something like a captain leading a team of 50 people. So Enki and Enli were both Yahweh, and but they were not the only one. So there were more.
Right.
That maybe if you connect this to the fact that in the Bible today we have God, Father, what do we have?
The Son.
Yahweh. Perhaps three or four names for God. In the original Bible, there were more than 40. So we
really?
Have El Shaddai, El Elohim.
I have a list of them Zabaoth, somewhere. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I've got a list of all the names.
Many of them.
Yeah.
And I assume that these were different people. There was Yahweh Yabaoth, there was Yahweh El Shaddai, there was Yahweh Elohim. Different persons.
Yes, you're opening up the gates of the conundrum in my head again when I'd let my mind settle on certain things for the past few years. But it's difficult. I can go off and read things about Egyptian philosophy and things, and they throw so many spanners in my works that I have to go off and calm down again and think about different things. Much of this, of course, is rooted, I would suggest, in Egypt. And Egypt is, it seems to me, is rooted in the fall of Atlantis.
Not only Egypt, it's also Jordan. When you mention Egypt and pharaohs, perhaps we should give the listeners the chance to say to learn about Jordan and the burial site of Alexander the Great. It is always a mystery for modern science. Where is Alexander the Great? Nobody ever found him, but they found him, but nobody talks about it.
Yeah, they did. I was going to say that. I thought I'd seen a story that a few years ago someone finally found the resting place, his resting place or wherever he was.
Yeah, and his resting place is very, very interesting. It's in a mountain in Jordan. I talked to one guy who was on site when they found it. For example, the entrance was covered with water, but not fluid water as we know it, but with solid water. And they couldn't go through this solid water curtain. No chance. No machine was able to go through it. So they finally dug a tunnel just around it to get around it. And when they touched this curtain from the inner side, it was fluid water again. It simply fell down as water.
Right.
When they then entered the site, they didn't only find Alexander the Great. They found many persons being buried there. I don't recall exactly the names, but I don't know if it was Nofretete. I'm not sure. But they found many from Egypt being there on site. They found an ark. They found precious stones as big as a football, many of them, lots of gold. It was very, very hot in there, and the cameras did not function very. But it's all online. There's a website showing all these pictures. Unfortunately, nobody's talking about it. I guess the reason is because the findings there could rewrite history in a very unpleasant way for the actual conquerors here of Western Europe and Western world.
Yeah. You know, I haven't looked at this material or this field for about 5 years now, and I'm suddenly realizing as you're touching on all these things. So when COVID arrived, I decided to just do something pragmatic for a few years, which is what I've been doing. And kind of, we were talking about this, weren't we? I don't know if we talked about it in last week's show, but I cut myself off from reading intentionally. It was a very conscious decision. I thought, how many more books do I need to read? Will I get to the bottom of everything? I came to the view that I'm not going to be able to do that. That it's very, very difficult. without a true guide, and where do you find one? And of course, I think to a great degree, your true guide is your own internal attitude. When you get yourself sorted out, you can suddenly learn in a way that you couldn't. Or your instincts for when you're in the presence of the truth increase. But of course, there have been so many vested interests down through history to persuade you of this, to persuade you of that. And in nearly all cases, it's to actually assign greater earthly power to a king or to a priesthood or whatever. They will twist things around. So it becomes difficult. But the Egyptian stuff, which I was looking at, where are we now? I suppose about 14 years ago. Good grief, it's a long time ago. About 2010, 11, 12, 13. That I found incredibly challenging in terms of trying to understand it, trying to comprehend this whole structure of their gods, the whole nature of what they're doing. I've read some absolute wonderful books with regards to that. Things that are transportive as you read them. There's a woman called... what's her book called? It's called The Winged Pharaoh, an English lady called Joan Grant. She wrote a series of novels called Far Memory Books. And it was said of her that she could effectively, you would call this almost, I suppose, like a channeled book these days, that was the word. But she was writing these in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And it was said of her that she could transport herself back in time and could be these characters. And Winged Pharaoh is the story of the daughter of the pharaoh as she is training to become a priestess in Egypt. Now, of course, I've not been in that period of history, but reading it, and I'm about to sneeze in a second if I don't watch it, reading it, here he comes. Is he going to go? Hang on. No, it's gone. No, it hasn't. It's terrible, isn't it? Yeah, I'm sad. I'm waiting to push the mute button. And my head's going to explode.
It's worse than sneezing.
It's worse. It's very unsatisfying, isn't it? And of course, you lose your. But it's she's training to become a priestess. There's something about the book is absolutely magical. Now, people say I've gone soft in the head, but I found it absolutely magical. So much so that I've never finished it on purpose. I have this bookmark about two-thirds of the way through, and I never really want the story to end. There's the most wonderful scenes in it. There's, I think I might have mentioned here, they have a court there, which is the sort of court I think you would like to see today. And her father is the pharaoh, and every now and again he has to pass judgment on criminals and people that have done things, or not criminals, as the case may be. And in the courtroom, or in his chamber, there is a priest who is with him, who has second sight. He can see the aura of people. He can read what's really going on with them, their true intentions, in this story. And she said her and her brother would often sneak in to see him at work. The other interesting creature that was in the court at the same time is a lion, a lioness. And the accused, if the priest thought the accused was lying through his back teeth, he would make a signal to the pharaoh. And the pharaoh would say to him, he said, come here and approach the lioness, Shemba, I think she's called. He said, she's very peaceful. He said, now, I want you to put your arm out. If you're telling the truth, she will lick your fist. And if you're not, she'll rip your arm out. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't mind a court like that. So people got very, very clear. These accused that came before the pharaoh in this story became very clear very quickly about whether they were going to tell the truth or not. I would imagine that a lioness would get you quite clear pretty quickly about where your priorities lie. And it's quite a magical book, and it taps into all of these teachings with regards to their view of the world, their view of life, their view of course, they have an array of gods. So it runs counter to the singular God, as it were, that we get from Scripture. But there again, it might not. I know that in some of the studies that certainly their view of Christ is a very good one as a great teacher, even though I know there are people who say he didn't even exist. In fact, one of them, a guy called Ken Humphreys, actually lives in my town. I see him. I think his website is Jesus Never Existed. And I've met him a couple of times. He's quite a nice guy. And he's quite clear about the fact that he didn't. So he comes from that sort of school of thinking. And there are others as well that I know have expressed it, and I've read some of their stuff. And yet, the power of the mind is such that these things tend to have a life of their own. And, you know, I also ask this other question. Is it, and this sounds asinine in a way, but the imagination being so powerful and stories being so powerful that they become the carrier way for these beliefs. And we have learnt more, I think, around campfires telling tales than probably any other form of communication. They're carried in us in a way. And I know we're taking a kind of more forensic view of these things and saying, can we actually ascertain all this stuff? And I think to some degree we can. I mean, you were mentioning there that obviously they've discovered Alexander's tomb. I know Comyns Beaumont identifies many, in his mind, he identified many of the geographical locations for the events as laid down in Scripture, giving it a real world, you know, focus. So all of these things come to play. Right now, never more than during these times, you know, as I said earlier, with regards to Velikovsky's title, mankind is in amnesia, and I suspect I am to some degree. I just hope it's less than it used to be. That's really what I'm trying to work at.
Think of a victim of let's say, rape or a very heavy accident with a car. It's common that those people often fall under amnesia, often for some days or weeks, perhaps or hours, but sometimes for a lifetime. If it's so bad what happened to them, they simply lock up this knowledge in their head and then never remember.
Yep.
And when you are thinking about what I told you earlier, when you are thinking about a moon-sized object coming close to Earth, being visible from horizon to horizon, from left to right, a moon coming closer and closer and closer. Well, this is kind of very frightening. And I can imagine that all the people there being on site and looking at this planet or moon coming closer, they are very afraid. And this is horrific, and a horrific experience. And if this happens every 13 years, of course, also the rhythm of 13 gets impregnated in your head, in your mind, mm-hmm. Into your DNA.
Yes, it does. So long as your timepieces are correct and the second is the right length and we've got the right calendar.
That's correct.
Yeah, and we've got the right calendar. You know, just coming back to where we started with calendars, is there a calendar that we should be using? Do you think there's a calendar in the world? I've seen people dating their websites with interesting calendars.
When you take a look at let's say, independent media, you often, in the last 2 or 3 years, read that there will be a flip back to the Julian calendar because the dates and the days are wrong. They have the wrong position in our year. We have to flip that back to the Julian calendar. It doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah.
Our orbit is the reason and the basis for our calendar, and our orbit is as it is now. We have these 365.2425 days, and that's it. We have to use a calendar based on what is our situation here on Earth.
Yeah.
If we, for some reason, I don't see now, might have the chance that the Earth's orbit is healed, the Earth's is pushed back a little bit more closer to the Sun, and the axis might be shifted away back into the vertical position. Well, then the situation might be different. Perhaps then we have again 360 days with exactly 24 hours, with exactly 60 minutes per hour in the original length, not as our day today. Our day is today 52 minutes longer than the original day on Earth.
Yes.
This is, for example, this is the reason why when you download an app on your mobile phone showing your biorhythm is only that strange because your biorhythm is based on our today's minutes, based on 24 hours and 52 minutes. It's still on the original time length. Our bodies, our biology is still working on the original length of our days. But our measurement today is not 24 hours, but it's 24 hours and 52 minutes.
Well, I don't know who messed all this up so much, Thomas. It's a complete mess, isn't it, really? Can they just come down and get it sorted out? We need it all. It's got to be put right.
We need a fixer.
Come we need here, a fixer. Yeah, we need a fixer. You know, the idea that there are 13 full moons during the year, of course, throws you off because 12 is such an amazing number.
I read something very, very interesting and funny just a few weeks ago. It's about 12 months. We all get our salary based on 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yeah.
So how many weeks has a month?
Supposedly it has four.
Four, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How many weeks has a year?
52.
Okay. And when you multiply 12 with 4, you get how much?
A mere 48.
Ah. So we have 13 months.
We do have 13 months. Yes, we do.
Yeah,
we absolutely do. Yeah,
we get crooked every single year. We get crooked by a complete month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do.
So a 13th salary is not a gift. It's a duty.
Yeah, you're basically saying there should be an extra payday, at least one monthly payday per 365 and a quarter days. Yeah.
Why not? That would
okay.
be fair.
I think it would be right and just, but we don't seem to live in a right and just world at the moment, do we? We seem to live in a lunatic asylum where people have got, power has gone to, I was going to say their heads, but it's probably their bottoms or something. I mean, yeah, it's very, very difficult to actually have sane conversations with people who appear to be literally hell-bent on destroying everything that we have been raised to consider as good and wholesome and of value. Such as families and you know, decent food and all this
family.
Kind of other stuff. Yes,
you're an old Nazi. Yeah,
I am. Yeah, I am. I can't help it. I didn't think I was, but it turns out that I am. I mean, somebody sent me the absolutely bizarre thing. If I can just dig it up here, this was how long have we got? 3 minutes. I might be able to read this out. I think. Where was this now? This was sent earlier today on the Telegram group that I have, and I said I would try and mention it, but of course I can't find the bloody thing when I want it. Where has it gone? Oh no, here it is. This is absolutely bizarre. This is from a chap called Craig Murray. I'll read it quickly. He's a man who's had political standing over here. He said, "This tweet is intended very seriously. Please read and understand it. Scottish law holds that anything on social media which can be read in Scotland is published in Scotland." I'll repeat that. Scottish law holds that anything on social media which can be read in Scotland is therefore classed as being published in Scotland. This is basically, it means Scotland, apparently, he's taking over ownership of the entire free speech of the internet. Anything at all. It goes on. It's not even a law. I don't know how you could even call that a law. That's obviously just another, you know, another raising for this, that, and the other, and whatever. Listen, I better play the outro music here. I've kind of forgotten that a little bit. We're just about to... let me just stop that there. There we go. So... thanks very much for joining us again. Bit of a clumsy end there, but I've been here with Thomas Anderson for the second week. Thomas, it's been great having you back this second time around.
Thank you.
Any final
me.
Closing words? We won't have you back next week. You're not doing 3 weeks in a row. We made up for last week's wonderful thing, but it's been a very different sort of show over the last couple of weeks, and I've really enjoyed it. It's been a kind of refreshing change in many ways, but we will have you back again in a month or so's time. Any final words? We've got a minute.
Well, we can use the same one as last time. Those who do not search the truth will not find it.
This is true. So we hope you've enjoyed being with Thomas here tonight. The Rumble stream will carry on for a bit after this, but we're going to leave WBN 324 and the other attendant stations in about 15 seconds, or about 30 seconds or so. We'll be back again, as I said, same time next week, next Thursday. I think I'm probably going to be joined by Dennis Wise next Thursday, so tune in then, and we'll carry on here on Rumble. So if you want to carry on listening, we've got about 15 seconds here. As I said, we're going to leave the radio stations imminently, but we'll be carrying on the chat and the discussion on Rumble. Go to paulenglishlive.com and click the Rumble link, and you can come over and we'll see what happens. Thanks very much. See you all next week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.